Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Drew Oyajay, and my guest today is Dr. Jemima Pierre. She is professor at the Social Justice Institute at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and a research associate at the University of Johannesburg. Today, we're talking about the dire situation in Haiti. For the past two decades, Canada has been a key player in a succession of military occupations of the country. Despite Canada's rhetoric about democracy promotion, it has in fact helped impose a series of undemocratic regimes that have culminated in the current crisis. Haiti's most recent presidential election was in 2016 and featured reports of widespread fraud. In 2021, President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, and more recently, his unelected successor, Ariel Henry, has been prevented from returning to the country after an overseas trip by gang leaders who are calling for his resignation, bringing the crisis once again to a head. All of this has happened while the U.S. has kept a tight grip on the reins of power in Haiti. As most informed observers note, this is a continuation of the way Haiti has been treated for over 200 years since its successful revolution in 1804, which overturned a brutal slavery-based system and put several European empires on the back foot. The history of Haiti cannot be done justice without several hours, and there are luckily a lot of great accounts that have been produced in recent years. That being said, Professor Pierre, what do you think is the most important thing for people in Canada to understand about the governmental collapse we see today?
Well, the most important thing about this governmental collapse is to understand that it is primarily the result of an extensive foreign meddling and interventions in Haiti. This latest one really goes back to 20 years ago when the U.S., France, and Canada planned to remove Haiti's democratically elected president and government through a coup d'etat and then using the United Nations Security Council as a way to actually hide that coup d'etat when they removed the president, and then dismantling that democratically elected government, including all the political structures of that government from the prime minister on down, allowing the attempted dismissal or destruction of the political party that brought him into power, and then installing from the very beginning, from 2004, an illegitimate set of government, so-called government agencies and peoples and parties, to the moment where we are here, where we actually have no elected officials in Haiti, which is unusual for any state. So to understand what's going on in Haiti is to understand the process that began the dismantling of the Haitian state in February 29, 2004. And if we don't do that, we can't really make a clear diagnosis of the problem or come up with some kind of solution to what's going on in Haiti.
What do you think is behind the decades of intervention and suppression of basic democratic functioning in Haiti? Why do the U.S. and its allies keep doing this?
It's Haiti's history, and Haiti's the second independent nation in the Western Hemisphere, but also the first completely free independent nation in the hemisphere, because Haiti's it was a colony, a very rich colony of France, where you had a large enslaved population of Africans, basically destroying the plantation system and slavery and white supremacy, defeating the world's most powerful army at the time. That was Napoleon's French army, which lost about 50,000 soldiers in Haiti to these enslaved Africans. So Haiti declared its independence after a 13-year brutal war against the French, but as well as the Spanish and the British, who tried to come in and steal what was left of this colony as the French were losing out to these Africans during this 13-year guerrilla war against the French. And I don't think the West has ever forgiven Haiti for that, for winning. Even after the revolution, what ended up happening was France trying to come back and take up its territory by threatening nonstop intervention into Haiti. The gunboats would show up on the shores and threaten to invade again. And you have to understand this was like a scorched earth war that these Africans had to fight. And so in 1825, the government of Haiti agreed to pay back France its money, to pay the enslavers money for losing their Africans, right? And so they had to pay this indemnity, which was, you know, 150 million gold francs, which is the equivalent of almost $30 billion today. And it took Haiti more than 100 years to finish paying this back. They didn't finish till 1947. And they were forced to pay it back because they would be threatened with invasion over and over again until they finished paying it. So I think that history is very important. The other part is Haiti is very significant for the region because of its position. It's in the Windward Passage where it's located. And the U.S. has always wanted to use Haiti as a way to stage its, you know, its imperialist ambitions. You know, people underestimate the role of Haiti as a source of not just mineral resources, but also human resources. People don't realize that Haiti is used as a sweatshop for Canadian products. Gildan products, for example, are put together in Haiti. And so it's cheaper to use Haiti. You know, you send the component parts down to Haiti and have them put together in Haiti. Canada's companies do it. The U.S. companies do it instead of using Asia as a way. So as they prepare to move away from using, you know, industries in Asia for cheap labor, they want to keep this captive workforce of 12 million people, which is one of the most populous places in the Caribbean, to use as cheap labor. So there's a lot of reasons, geopolitically as well as, you know, culturally and racially, that there's a need to control Haiti. The problem with Haiti is that the Haitians have always protested in particular ways. So it's this constant resistance, I think, for 200 years, that's actually, they have not taken this lying down. And I think that's also part of the reason why there's this constant onslaught, constant need to invade, reinvade, occupy, and so on.
When you look at the history, it really feels like there's, you know, 200 years of resistance to colonialism and slavery. And then there's also 200 years of this sort of imperial resentment. And it's interesting you mentioned Gildan, because I remember after the 2004 coup, if you know, we looked at Gildan's stock price on that day, a day later, like it went up a hefty percentage. It's just remarkably direct in terms of how investors perceived the coup in Haiti and who it was benefiting. In 2004, Canada sent soldiers, police officers, government experts, development NGOs to back the post-coup regime led by Gerard Latortue, as you mentioned, who replaced after Jean-Bertrand Aristide was unceremoniously flown off to the Central African Republic by U.S. Marines. But this time around, the U.S. has asked the Canadians to take a leadership role in a new mission, but this time Canada has refused. Instead, they've sent troops to Jamaica to train soldiers from Belize and the Bahamas on their way to Port-au-Prince. What do you think has made them stay away this time? What do you think has made Canada decline?
Well, I think there's a lot going on. I have to say, the Gerard Latortue, I want it because there's a lot of parallels to what happened in 2004. To what's been happening in Haiti, and the fact that once the Marines landed in Aristide's house, put him on in trucks and took him to the airport to fly him out to Africa, to send him back to Africa. There were already hundreds of French, Canadian, and U.S. soldiers in Haiti that came over, that were there on the ground. And then you have the U.S. ambassador, James Foley, going to the house of the head of the Supreme Court in Haiti and basically telling them that he's going to be interim president. So already we're against the Haitian constitution, because the only way that the Supreme Court justice can be become president is through parliamentary vote and action. But the U.S. State Department official was able to basically say, you're now president, right? And while we still had a sitting prime minister, which was not even consulted, right, in this. And then they removed them and brought in Gerard Latortue too. And I have to say this, because who had been living in Boca Raton, Florida for 15 years, flown in to be brought in, where a Haitian constitution says you cannot take office if you have not lived in the country for at least 5 years. So they threw away every kind of legal mechanism that the Haitian state had put in place. They basically dismantled the state from that moment. And then you had the core group that were put in, which is, they call themselves the Friends of Haiti, but this was like the people that politically ran Haiti through the UN. So the core group includes US, France, Canada. And notice that France is always involved here, even though they're all the way, you know, in Europe, they're always in Haiti's business, right? And so, you know, it's France right now negotiating for Haiti's new government. So that's an important thing to think about. So this occupation lasts from 2004, this heavy military presence in Haiti. And I remember going to Haiti, seeing these tanks going through these tiny towns. Haiti was not a country at war, but they were under occupation by the UN. The UN is responsible for thousands of deaths and homicides, rapes, sexual exploitation, as well as bringing cholera to Haiti, right? Killing, people are saying 30,000, but also sickening more than a million, right? So this is the occupation that was unleashed on Haiti after following this coup d'etat, in addition to the dismantling of the Haitian state. I think that the US new policy was not to actually lead another intervention. I think part of it is the visual imagery of having white soldiers pointing guns at these Black Haitian people in this day of, you know, quick phones and, you know, iPhones and, you know, Google phones, like taking pictures and uploading pictures and so on and so forth. And I also think the U.S. realized through Haiti, that's why I say Haiti's a laboratory, that it could be cheaper to get a whole bunch of different people to do the dirty work for them. Because that's what the U.N. occupation did. It was a cheap thing where you had the U.N. pay for an occupation that the U.S., France, and Canada wanted. And you had buy-in from all these countries from all over the world to come and occupy Haiti. But by the time the U.S. installed this prime minister in 2021 and all the protests that they were calling these protests gangs, right? And that's why I'm weary about using the term gangs, because I think what's happening in Haiti, these groups are paramilitary groups, they're armed groups. But the U.S., the governments in Haiti, the unpopular governments have always used the term gangs as a way to say these protests are not legitimate. These people are gangs. So we have to like make that distinction. But by the time they did that, I think the U.S. wanted someone else to take the lead. And Canada, if you look at the time, Canada said no. And I think there's even a New York Times article that says Canada lacks the resources to actually take on a full-blown occupation, but also doesn't see the value because they don't want to get stuck in Haiti. Because you go to Haiti, you're going to get stuck because then you're going to actually have to really shoot people, shoot all these young people. Haiti's population, the majority of the population is under 24 years old, right? And so imagine the imagery of like these white soldiers from Canada and the U.S. shooting down 14, 15, 16-year-old black kids, right, in Haiti. So I don't think Canada wanted to do that, but they wanted to support the U.S. occupation because they need Haiti. They worked with the U.S. to try and push CARICOM, the Caribbean countries, to actually take the lead. They tried to get Brazil to do it. Brazil did not want to get marred in that because of the way that the leftist organization in Brazil were very much up against this occupation that Brazil participated to from 2004 to 2017. So they did not want to seem like they were taking the lead, which is why the U.S. then had to go all the way to Kenya to find the most neo-colonial government that it could pay $200 million to occupy, to just come do this dirty job of occupying and invading Haiti.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about this contrast of Canada's position in 2004 versus now. And some of the officials at the time have actually said that they needed to pay the U.S. back for not supporting the Iraq War. And so that was sort of their way to get back in the good books of the U.S.
France, too. They both used Haiti to get back and on the, you know, to make up for Iraq. France and Canada.
Yeah. One of the things that you can't really capture in a 30-minute conversation is how all the really minute and larger ways that Haiti has been made to pay for the revolution 200 and some years ago, but also the continuing resistance. I mean, it's remarkable how it filters down, not just from the US to Canada to, you know, all these other CARICOM countries and so on. I wanted to loop back to Canada, which has, in addition to sort of sending troops to Jamaica to do this training, is also putting $100 million just this year toward policing within Haiti, which is, you know, a tidy sum to say the least. But from your perspective, what does that money buy?
That money buys Canadian equipment and U.S. equipment. So the money goes right back. I mean, let's be real. I mean, that's how U.S. wars work, right? So like money, you know, when you say you're going to give military aid to Ukraine, what it means is you're setting up the military industrial complex for more contracts, right? And so I do know that the Canadian government, for example, shipped a bunch of armored vehicles to the Haitian police that they paid for, the Haitian police supposedly paid for. To me, when we're thinking about this aid, what's fascinating is, you know, Canada also provided, I think, what, $3 million for the Kenyans to go learn French. the Kenyan force, and I remind you, can you imagine you have like this force coming, they don't speak our language, they don't speak, first of all, most people don't speak French, they speak Creole, but they're paying for that. I also want to point out how whatever solution these Western powers have for Haiti is always a violent one. It's always about force. It's always about prisons. Like, the, you know, after the earthquake, the first thing the U.S. built was two prisons. The biggest, you know, infrastructure aid that the U.S. has provided to Haiti has been the construction of three prisons, right? They don't build schools. They don't build hospitals. They don't do anything, but create this carceral, it's a carceral logic, violence and imprisonment. that's what they think of when they think of us.
One of the things that's interesting about reading sort of media accounts of what's happening in Haiti is that, you know, I sort of read them having the sneaking suspicion, and also, you know, the accounts of some colleagues who have been on the ground and sort of seen it firsthand, but that the point of view that's being reported or sympathized with are the sort of people in these sort of wealthy or extremely wealthy neighborhoods, and not the majority of people who live in either displaced camps, you know, villages or popular neighborhoods. So when we're reading reporting from Haiti, I mean, I guess, do you have that sense as well? And I guess, do you think we need some kind of find and replace function to sort of, to be able to interpret it, make sense of the reporting that comes out of Haiti?
Well, two things. One of the things, you know, the reporting on Haiti is racist. I mean, you had like reports that there are cannibals in Haiti. It's almost as if it hadn't changed from the 1800s, right? And so the reporting is racist. The other thing, I'm glad you mentioned Port-au-Prince and Pétionville, because if you watch the Western media on Haiti, you would think the whole country is in flames, that there's a civil war going on, you can't go anywhere. But then you wouldn't be able to explain why the commercial airport in northern Haiti is still open and their flights coming in and out. Okay, so Haiti's up in flames, but you could still have JetBlue and Spirit Airlines fly in every day, right? So there's that. So one of the things that happens is that people take Port-au-Prince as a representation of the entire country. Like, I've seen images from the earthquake in 2010 to represent what's going on today, as if, you know, things are falling apart in at that scale. So the first thing I want to say is, what's happening in Haiti, most of the violence is happening in the Port-au-Prince area, in the popular neighborhoods. And that's been happening for a long time. This is not it's flared up because, you know, now the people in the elite neighborhoods are getting, some of them, you know, sometimes the elite, the armed groups might move close to Pétionville, the rich area, right? In the hills, right? The rich people live in the hills, which is why the helicopters now can just land up there and put them in there and fly them to Cape Haitien, that they can fly out of Haiti. But if you look at the map of Port-au-Prince, you have like these, what they call popular neighborhoods, quartier populaire. You have all of them. You know, they're very concentrated, you know, very poor, impoverished people, which is where the UN forces used to go in and shoot up, you know, just, you know, empty their cartridges onto the population there, right? These populations have been suffering under, that's where the resistance is, they've been suffering under armed groups paid by the politicians for years. For years, people have been killed, young people, that has not made the news, right, in the sense that they are. And so it's only now that these armed groups have gotten together, they seem to have a little more money, that then it becomes, oh my God, the country is under siege. And it's not to say that it's not, like these, you know, but what you see when you see burning tires in these images are neighborhoods actually protecting themselves. You know, they set up barricades, they set up, you know, sandbags and so on and so forth to stop people from coming in, right? So you see that that doesn't get explained. You think the whole country is in flames, that doesn't get explained. It is. It does then represent the views of some of the Haitian elite that are saying they're under siege. And my thing is, why didn't you say that about all the, you know, the young people in the poor neighborhoods that were being shot up at the behest of politicians and the oligarch 2 years ago, 3 years ago, or when Jovenel Moïse and Michel Martelly would send armed groups into these neighborhoods and shoot them up? BBC, CNN, Voice of America, they have the same story. And if we know how neocolonial, how the media works globally, all these countries in Africa and Latin America, what do? They cut and paste from BBC, CNN, Voice of America, and they repeat the same story. So you manufacture consent. So everybody I talked to outside of the U.S. was like, oh my God, your country, I'm so sorry. The whole country's in the civil wars and flames. And so I, you know, for me, the media is just as responsible for the violence that is coming to Haiti, that has been on Haitian people, and that's going to come with its invention. But the other thing is, the people that get interviewed in Haiti are the people that are holed up in Port-au-Prince. In fact, I was on a TV show with someone who's just like, yeah, you know, I'm stuck in my house. I haven't been able to leave a few days. And then I go down the street and, you know, my driver's passing by and I see, you know, bodies here and there. And I'm like, you have a driver. Oh, well, that's interesting, right? So part of that is just really interesting. The other thing is the foreign forces, like even after the earthquake in Haiti, the people that made off the best, the people that made off with all that money that was distributed supposedly on behalf of Haiti, are the economic elite in Haiti. They're the ones that actually benefit from foreign invasion, because then they get the subcontracts, even though it might not be that, but they get the, you know, their hotels get filled up. They can rent cars to the aid agencies and so on and so forth. So of course they're going to be behind invasion, because they're not the ones getting killed, because they're living in fortified compounds in the hills of Haiti.
I guess turning to the diaspora, I mean, you yourself, as I understand, are a member of the Haitian diaspora, which is certainly a huge presence in Montreal and some other Canadian cities as well. Can you describe how you see the response from people here in Canada who have relations in Haiti? And what's the range of reactions? And do you see any points of consensus emerging, or is there a, you know, a common progressive position?
I have to say, I moved to Canada from the US 9 months ago. And so that's an important point to make. And so that's not to, you know, so that's to say that I don't know the range of responses in Canada, but I can generally say that there are a range of responses. You have the older generation that was very much in support of the Aristide Lavalas and are still angry about the 2004 coup d'etat. And I think that that's still the progressive voice. What you've had over the years, what I've noticed, which is fascinating, is a bureaucratic class. Like a bureaucratic upper middle class that are like in, you know, especially Miami, for example, in government, right? Like they're the Haitian American legal groups and Haitian American Lawyers Association or Haitian American elected officials that actually take on a similar view as the U.S. State Department. And they think that they need to, for example, lobby representatives here and there to support invasion, right? I see that a lot of them are supporting invasion. But you do have a strong progressive group, especially in Ottawa, right? And you do have a lot of progressive organizations that actually have been consistent against Canadian role in the continued occupation, because Haiti is under occupation. It's been under occupation for 20 years by these foreigners. So there is. So you have these three groups, I think. Two of them are more progressive, but the bureaucratic ones are the ones I think that these governments are listening to, because they speak that particular language, of technocrats, right? Like the solution should be done in a boardroom in Washington, D.C. or Ottawa, you know, to figure out what's going on to Haiti, as opposed to the grassroots organizations, I think, that you have. The other thing is, among that, the younger generation, what you have is the belief in the demonization of Aristide and the Lavalas party that came from 2004. There was a major media thing. There's a great article called How to Turn a Priest into a Cannibal, where the U.S. basically presented this view of Aristide as like the devil incarnate, right? You linking him to like Hitler and this and that, to really demonize the movement, the people's movement, but also make it seem like he was like behind all this violence and so on and so forth. And I think a lot of these young people who grew up with the media representation of Aristide believe it, right? And they believe some of it. And that's why they don't see, for example, the figure of Guy Philippe, right, who was part of the groups that were funded and trained by US and Canada, the paramilitary guy that wreaked havoc while Aristide was government, and that the US called the freedom fighter in the 2004 coup d'etat. People are supporting him now, not realizing that he was funded by the CIA and trained by U.S. Special Forces in Ecuador and the Dominican Republic, right? And so you do have this generational difference, but I do think there's a key group of people who actually understand it through time, right? That understand what's happened over the last 20 years in particular, and that, you know, at the very least, no one should trust the U.S. U.S. imperialism is not benevolent. Neither is Canadian imperialism. The other thing is, I don't think people see Canada as an imperialist power, right? They don't. They think that they see Canada as like following the steps of the U.S. But we have to actually be clear and see Canada as having its own imperialist role, because Canada, remember, you know, it's Canadian companies that own most of the mining on the African continent, right? There's gold in Haiti. There's already, you know, Canadian corporations trying to work on this gold. Also, people don't realize that Canada has a military base in the Caribbean, in Jamaica. In fact, they use that military base for espionage right after independence in the region to go against supposed communist nations, you know, to stop any communism that could have taken hold in the 60s and 70s. So we have to be very clear that what these nations are doing are not for Haitians, are not because they care about what happens in Haiti.
It's interesting what you're saying about Guy Philippe, because it just makes me realize that the majority of Haitians who are alive today were at a maximum, like, I guess, 6 or 7 years old when the 2004 coup happened. And so the political consciousness is very much,
exactly,
you know, taking shape in the context of this, like, ongoing, endless, from their perspective, military occupation. Just to wrap up, what do you think is the most important thing for Canadians to do in response to this crisis, which we're so deeply involved in creating?
I think the thing is to just tell your government to step aside and leave Haiti alone. And I know that sounds crazy, because you're told that you have to do something because things are so bad, you have to do something. Let me just remind you, Haitian people defeated Napoleon's army, they fought a war, and they became independent on their own. And Haiti has the capacity to do the same. And so I do think we have to step back and be respectful enough of Haitian sovereignty and Haitian humanity to allow people to do what they need to do without the constant meddling of US, France, Canada into our affairs. So the first thing, the most important thing that Canadians can do, Canadian leftists in particular, is to rally with Haitian people against intervention, against the constant meddling by the Canadian government. You need to stop the Canadian government from participating in this this ongoing occupation of Haiti, from militarizing Haiti, from sending only military forces and so on and so forth, but also their NGOs, which actually everybody makes their careers of Haiti. The most important thing is to leave Haiti alone. And I say this, you know, with all the love for our Canadian brothers and sisters, but the message is leave Haiti alone and tell your government to leave us alone.
Jemima Pierre, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you like what you've heard on The Breach Show, please subscribe to the podcast or our YouTube channel. And if you want to support our work, please become a sustaining member to help us produce more journalism for transformation. You can do that at breachmedia.ca/support. Thanks for listening.